Hey y'all, Darius Rucker here. You know, a lot of people ask me, what inspires your music? And one of the big things is a strong sense of place. That's why I love my home state of South Carolina and want to share the awesome things it has to offer. From the beautiful mountains down to the sunny coast, it's got it all. Not to mention two of my personal favorites, great golf and amazing food. Come see why I love this place. Visit discoversouthcarolina.com.
Fall is all about cozy comforts, but when you're prioritizing your health, it's easy to feel like you're missing out. With Hero Bread, you can enjoy all your fall favorites because they're made with Hero Bread sliced bread loaves, tortillas, bagels, dinner rolls, and more. Try their all-new Hero Noodles with 12 grams of protein and just 80 calories. So skip replacing every carb with cauliflower and indulge in your breakfast, lunch, and dinnertime favorites while still hitting your goals. From breakfast bagels and meal-prepped enchiladas to mouth-watering burgers and cheesy noodles, you won't believe Hero Bread's options have 0 to 5 grams net carbs and are high fiber from the taste and texture. They've even got small batch drops of indulgent favorites like the popular Hero Croissant. And right now, Hero Bread is offering 10% off your order. Go to hero.co and use code FALL25 at checkout. That's FALL25 at HERO.CO. All figures are per serving of Hero Bread. Contains 2 to 18 grams of fat per serving. See the product nutrition panels on Hero.co for more information.
On April 10th, 1997, 50-year-old Judy Smith, a beloved nurse and mother, set off for her first trip to Philadelphia, planning to explore historic sites while her husband attended a conference. But when Judy didn't return to their hotel that evening, her husband grew worried and reported her missing. Months passed without a word from Judy. Then in September, hunters stumbled upon her remains over 600 miles away in a remote part of North Carolina. Her body had been wrapped in a blanket and left in a shallow grave. It was clear that Judy had been murdered. It's been over 27 years since Judy was killed, and investigators are still searching for the person responsible. Hey everyone, welcome back to Detective Perspective. My name is Derek Levasseur. I'm a licensed private investigator and former police detective. Each week I'll be covering an unsolved case in story format. I'll then give you my perspective on the investigation and provide contact information for the individuals and organizations connected to the case so that if you have any tips, you can contact them directly and maybe you can help solve a case. So if you're someone who's interested in true crime, specifically unsolved cases, and you would like to hear my opinion on those investigations, please consider subscribing whether you're watching on YouTube or listening on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or whatever platform you use. Okay, Judy Smith. Older case, definitely different than last week's case, which was only 5 months old. So why are we covering it? Well, the same reason we cover any case on Detective Perspective. We want answers. And from what I've researched, from what I've found, there's not a lot of coverage on this case now. And that's a problem because time is of the essence here. Many witnesses, many people actually involved with this investigation, they're deceased now. And so as time progresses, it becomes less and less likely that we'll get answers that we're all seeking in this case for not only the friends and family of the victim, but everyone from those communities affected by this, not only in Philadelphia, but also North Carolina. So looking at what we have here, this case kind of, it makes me go back and forth. One second, I think one thing. I go back and think about it for a few more minutes, and then I think another. So I'm really interested in hearing what you guys think about this one. There could be a simple explanation as to what happened here, even though we do not know who killed her. Or there could be much more to the story that is yet to be uncovered. Either way, I don't think anything's going to happen unless people like us come together to kind of re-energize the case, bring Judy's story to the forefront, and make it like it just happened yesterday. That's what our job here is. So with that in mind, let's dive into this week's case. Judith Lois Eldridge, who went by Judy, was born on December 15, 1946 in Massachusetts. Not much is known about Judy's childhood, but as an adult, she worked as a registered nurse and a case manager. Judy was loved by her patients, and the feeling was mutual. In the late 1980s, Judy was caring for a man recovering from surgery when she met the man's son, Jeff Smith. Jeff quickly noticed Judy's great personality and practical nature. He later told the Philadelphia City Paper that he found out they had a lot in common. Both were divorced and raising children alone. Jeff had a daughter from his first marriage, while Judy had a daughter and a son from her second. They also shared a common interest in healthcare, Judy as a nurse, and Jeff as an attorney who represented the Northeast Pharmaceutical Conference. When Judy finished working with Jeff's father, they went on a date, and the rest was history. They fell in love, but didn't marry right away. Instead, they spent about 10 years together in Newton, Massachusetts, before finally marrying in 1996. Months later, Judy would disappear. In 1997, from April 9th to the 11th, Jeff had to attend a Northeast Pharmaceutical Conference in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Judy planned to join him on the trip so she could do some sightseeing. On Wednesday, April 9th, Jeff and Judy were scheduled to fly to Philadelphia together. But when they got to the airport for their 1:30 p.m. flight, Judy realized that she had left her driver's license at home. And without a photo ID, she wasn't allowed to board the plane. Now, according to the Philadelphia City Paper, Jeff had a meeting that afternoon, so he went ahead while Judy returned home to grab her license. She ended up catching a 7:30 p.m. flight and took a cab to the DoubleTree Hotel on the corner of Broad and Locust Street, where she eventually met up with Jeff. That evening, they talked about Judy's plans for the next day. This was Judy's first time in Philadelphia, so she wanted to visit the main tourist sites, especially the Liberty Bell and Independence Hall. They both agreed that Judy should try to get back to the hotel by 5:30 p.m. so they could get ready for a cocktail party they were going to attend. Jeff later told the city paper that he wasn't worried about Judy exploring the city on her own. She was 50 years old and, as he described, a quote, inordinarily self-reliant person who traveled to many foreign countries by herself. On April 10th, Jeff got up early and went to breakfast on his own. When he returned to the room just before 9 a.m., Judy was in the shower, but they still talked for a few minutes, and then Jeff left for the opening of his presentation. Now, the conference activities, they kept Jeff pretty busy throughout the day. He moderated the last session, then he returned to the hotel room around 5:30 p.m., expecting to find Judy there, but she wasn't. Jeff noticed that Judy had taken as much as $200 in cash with her, but left $500 behind in the room. She had also taken her American Express gold card and a phone charge card. And although Jeff was a little bit concerned at this point, he figured there just must have been a misunderstanding as far as their plans. But by 6:15 p.m., that concern grew, so he decided to speak with concierge and a hotel security guard, and when he filled them in on what was going on, the concierge started calling hospitals, but they had no record of Judy being there. Jeff later told the Philadelphia City Paper that from that point on, everything was a blur. He grabbed a cab and asked the driver to follow the route for Philadelphia's public transit service, also known as Flash, and that's spelled P-H-L-A-S-H, which he knew that Judy had planned on using that day. Unfortunately, they didn't spot her anywhere, so he decided to return to the hotel. He later took another cab to the police department, where he was given a list of hospitals to call, and with the help of a nurse, he called each one of them, but there was no sign of Judy anywhere. Jeff then called his daughter to check for any messages and reached out to Judy's children, but no one had heard from her. Now, with all of this going on and not really having any luck, at around midnight, Jeff tried to report Judy missing, but the police refused, saying that she hadn't been missing long enough. And I know this is something that pisses a lot of you off. I know I've talked about it before. I will talk about it again, but just give me a minute. So in this particular circumstance, a detective at the station said that if Jeff really wanted to push it, he could file a report the next morning, 24 hours after she had last been seen. So Jeff returned to the hotel room and waited, not sleeping or even changing his clothes for the next several hours. I know this one is something, it's a polarizing topic, and a lot of you say, well, why can't they do this? If they know she's missing and her husband's coming in and he knows her better than anyone, why wouldn't you take him at his word and just file the report? Here's what I'll say. I wasn't there. I don't know exactly what transpired, but I can tell you that there's a lot of policy and procedure behind it, especially with adults, that you're not supposed to enter them before 24 hours unless there's an underlying circumstances, whether it's a mental health issue or other circumstances that would suggest this person is in trouble, right? Doesn't appear that there was any of that here, although her behavior was a little out of the ordinary. And when they say they can't report her missing, I understand that. I can only speak from my own anecdotal experience, but even if that's the case, what I would normally do is say, hey, listen, it's only been, you know, 8 hours or whatever. I'm not going to send you away. We're going to look into this. What are some of the phone numbers you have? Does she have any relatives nearby, friends that she could have visited? Give me everything you got. I'm going to put out a bulletin to everybody who's on the streets. We'll give a description. We're going to try to track her down for you. I'm going to sit behind this desk with you, and we're going to make some calls to the hospitals, to anything we can to try to find her. And so there are efforts that are taking place. And then once we hit that 24-hour mark, now we can enter her into NCIC as a missing person. So just to kind of put that all in a bow, can she be officially entered unless there's circumstances that would dictate that? No, but it doesn't mean that a search can't take place before those 24 hours. So I definitely want to know more about this situation. Did they really just send him home and say, we're not touching this until we hit 24 hours on the dot? That wouldn't make a lot of sense to me, because what changes between hour 23 and hour 24, other than potentially really hurting the case? Because if she is in danger, those first 24 to 48 hours are absolutely critical. But it was 27 years ago. I wasn't there. If it went down exactly the way I just explained it, I don't agree with it. There should have been steps taken before he came back and reported her missing officially. But I can only tell you what I would have done in the situation, and it would not have been sending the reporting party home. We got a lot more to cover. There's going to be some more twists in this story. And as you know from the teaser, it's not good news. So let's take a first break. We'll be right back. All right, we're back. And before break, I was talking about the filing of a missing person report, when it can be done, when it can't be done. And as we know, in this case, Jeff was not allowed to file that report. So he went home, basically just stayed up for a few hours. And then on April 11th, he went back to the police station and officially reported Judy missing. And this time the police took the report, but Jeff still felt like they weren't taking his concerns seriously. He later told the Philadelphia City Paper that detectives kept saying she probably took off voluntarily and that she might have been having some type of midlife crisis and had taken off for a few days to, quote, see if anyone would miss her. That's a direct quote. Now, obviously, Jeff found this idea extremely offensive and disagreed completely. And I'm on board with him. I'm on Team Jeff here. When someone comes in to report their wife missing, you believe them, because they know that person better than you do. Yes, you want to take the report. You want to gather as much information as possible. But if the person reporting the situation, Jeff in this case, seems squared away, which by all accounts he did, and there's no previous history of her doing something like this, you go all out and you try to find her as fast as possible. It's been 24 hours. She hasn't contacted anyone. This is not normal behavior, and it's your responsibility at that point not to come up with theories about a person you don't know, but to do your job. Find her as quick as possible. That's all that's important at this point. Now, I will say this. Despite some detectives thinking that Judy had run off on her own, they did start conducting interviews. And on April 12th, the police insisted on interviewing Judy's daughter, Amy, as soon as she arrived in Philadelphia to help with the search. Now, according to Amy, they questioned her extensively about Jeff, and Amy explained that Judy had no reason to hide from him. They were extremely happy together, and they made a great couple. Now, after speaking with Amy, the police seemed to take Judy's disappearance much more seriously. They immediately began piecing together a timeline of Judy's movements while she was in Philadelphia. They very quickly found out that Judy hadn't used her American Express gold card or her phone charge card. She hadn't accessed any of her bank accounts, and her passport was still at home, which helped narrow down the search. The police then turned their focus to people who might have seen her on April 10th. According to the Philadelphia City Paper, At sometime after 9 a.m., Judy asked a hotel employee where she could catch the Flash Center City van service, which stopped near the Liberty Bell and the Visitor Center. Judy then left the hotel dressed in blue jeans, white sneakers, a dark three-quarter length coat, and was also carrying a red backpack which she was known to have with her at all times. A few hours later, a Flash driver picked Judy up at Front and South, which was about a half mile away from the Visitor Center. She was later seen about a mile away entering and leaving a Greyhound bus terminal located at 11th and Filbert, and from what we have been able to gather, it's believed that she was most likely using the restrooms there. At approximately 3 p.m., witnesses reported seeing Judy about a half mile from the bus terminal near Broad and Locust. And for the first time that day, Judy was described by witnesses as, quote, acting disoriented. And as you can imagine, Judy's family couldn't understand why she would be acting like that. And I think it's important to note that just 2 weeks before her disappearance, she had a full physical and was found to be in good health. Here's where the story starts to take some unexpected turns, because the next reported sighting of Judy was nearly 24 hours later, but this time she was in Deptford, New Jersey, which is about 14 miles from Broad and Locust. And at this time, she was seen shopping for dresses at a Macy's in the Deptford Mall. Not what you would expect to hear when this person is missing and is believed by some to be in danger. And I know some of you may be thinking, well, maybe it was a misidentification. Maybe it was someone who resembled Judy. But here's the problem with that. Both a salesperson and a customer recalled Judy and described her right down to the red backpack. And that's significant because, yes, there might have been some other people at the mall with a backpack. But how many adults that look like Judy would be at a mall with a red backpack only 14 miles away from where she was last seen? Highly unlikely. Now, here's the interesting thing. According to these witnesses, they also noted that she seemed unstable. They reported that Judy kept mentioning buying clothes for her daughter and commented that her daughter often didn't like the clothes she picked out for her. And then these witnesses said that when Judy was getting ready to leave, she tried to get a young woman standing nearby to leave with her, as if she thought this woman was her daughter. Obviously, the police couldn't figure out why Judy would be in Deptford, but if she was disoriented like everyone was describing, we have to acknowledge that it is possible she boarded the wrong bus accidentally and wound up in a place that she wasn't familiar with. But if that's true, why wouldn't she contact anyone? Why wouldn't she find a phone and say, hey, Amy, I'm at the mall and I'm looking to pick you up some dresses. Do you want something? Or call Jeff and say, hey, I got a little lost, or I don't know exactly where I am, but I'm at a mall. I'm going to grab something and then I'm going to head toward the hotel. Nothing. She doesn't try to call anyone. So maybe she was that disoriented where she felt like she was in the right place and she was going to still be home on time. I don't know. It doesn't make a lot of sense to me. But I also asked the question, if she was this disoriented, why wouldn't someone notify authorities at that moment? Maybe security at the mall to say, hey, listen, there's this woman walking around. She's not making a lot of sense. Maybe someone should check on her. Now, I know that's hindsight and I'm not blaming anyone, but it does make you think in a lot of these cases how one decision could have changed the outcome of this story. And it's just difficult to know that just one minor act could result in a completely different outcome. I guess it's something we can think about moving forward as we go on with our own lives and we think about these cases, and maybe you encounter a similar situation and you're on the fence about whether or not to notify someone or to report it. Maybe you'll think of Judy's case and say, you know what? I'd rather be safe than sorry. Now, unfortunately, the Deptford sighting is the last credible report of Judy that we have. There were several tips placing her near Penn's Landing, back near the Visitor Center in Philadelphia, but police and her family believe these witnesses likely saw a homeless woman known to frequent the area who looked a lot like Judy. So the search continued on, but there were no other sightings of Judy, and eventually Jeff and Judy's kids had to return to Boston. Jeff kept in close contact with the Philadelphia police. He even asked them to involve the FBI. However, he was told the case did not meet the necessary criteria. And I have to tell you, don't kill the messenger. I agree with this stance. the FBI, they have a lot of cases. They have to evaluate which ones they take on. And it's also Philadelphia's responsibility, the police department, to also evaluate the case as well. And what we have right now is a woman who appears to be okay, maybe something going on mentally. We're not 100% sure, but she's out there. She's buying clothes. She doesn't appear to be in any immediate danger. And it's still very possible that she's out there and she doesn't want to be found. So to call up the FBI and ask them to get involved with this case, I personally wouldn't do that as a sergeant. And to be completely frank, even if I did, the FBI would more than likely turn me down. So Jeff gets back home, and according to Unsolved Mysteries, from his office, he faxes and mails 9,000 flyers about Judy to police departments and hospitals along the East Coast. He also hired 3 private investigators, but they didn't find anything significant. In mid-July, Jeff sat down with the Philadelphia City paper to talk about the case. When asked what he thought happened to Judy, he said he preferred to believe she was still alive. However, he admitted that he wasn't sure what could have happened to her. He went on to describe Judy as a fighter and pointed out that she could be very loud at times, so he couldn't imagine a scenario where she would be kidnapped without making a scene. Jeff also didn't think Judy would go with someone voluntarily or take off on her own. Judy's son Craig also agreed. He told the city paper, quote, "She wouldn't have done that to me and my sister." However, not everyone was in agreement. Judy's friend Carolyn told the police that at the time of Judy's disappearance, her marriage with Jeff was, quote, "very tenuous." Carolyn believed that something might have happened that made Judy want time away from him. So here we are. 2 different outlooks on this, 2 different perspectives. Who are we to believe? Your guess is as good as mine. On one hand, I want to believe Jeff. He knew his wife better than anyone. However, if there was something going on between them, even if Jeff is not in any way, shape, or form responsible, spoiler alert, I don't believe he was, it's difficult for someone to tell law enforcement, yeah, me and my wife have been having problems when she's currently missing. Because you know what's going to happen. They're going to point their eyes right at you and think you did it. So you got to be careful, and it's very difficult to come out and be completely forthright because you know by doing so, you could be implicating yourself even though you have nothing to do with it. And I understand that human response. I'd like to think that law enforcement wouldn't get tunnel vision, but we all know statistically when someone goes missing or something happens like this, it's usually someone they know. More importantly, it's usually a spouse or a significant other. And so if you say something like, yeah, we were going through tough times, you're going to get the side eye from detectives. There's no doubt about it. And that's coming from a detective. So I understand where if he doesn't think that information is valuable, and when I say he, I mean Jeff, he may choose to omit the fact that at the time they were struggling a little bit. It was nothing serious, but maybe they were having some spats. And let's be honest, many couples in marriages do. So it's not completely out of the ordinary. So when Carolyn mentions that the relationship was very tenuous, I would want more information. I would want to know if it ever escalated to the point where there was physical abuse. I would want to know if Judy ever stated that she was afraid of Jeff and feared for her safety. These are all questions that I would have. And maybe they do have the answers to those questions and we just don't know about it. As far as Craig is concerned, I have no doubt that he believes what he's saying. And you know what? He's right. He's absolutely right. Maybe his mother would never do this to him and his sister. Maybe something happened that prevented her from stopping it. So although she would never willingly do something like this, maybe she lost the ability to make that decision. And that could be due to something mentally taking place or something physically taking place. And just to throw out the third scenario that I'm sure many of you are thinking about, maybe Judy just wanted to be alone for a while. Maybe she actively chose to do this with the intentions on returning at some point, or at least making contact with family members and friends, but something prevented her from eventually doing that. Okay, let's fast forward to September 7th. About 10 miles outside of Asheville, North Carolina, a few hunters were in the Pisgah National Forest near the Stony Point picnic area off NC 151 when they stumbled upon a partially buried skeleton. they immediately contacted authorities. The Buncombe County Sheriff's Department arrived and found that animals had scattered some of the skeletal remains over a 100-yard area, while the main skeleton was in a shallow grave wrapped in a blue blanket. According to the Philadelphia Inquirer, the remains were dressed in long insulated underwear, blue jeans, and hiking boots. The pockets were empty, there was no wallet or identification, but there was a diamond wedding ring on the left hand. Nearby, in shallow holes dug into the ground, police found a pair of expensive sunglasses and a blue vinyl backpack containing winter clothes and $80 in cash. A shirt was also buried close by with $87 in its pocket. Given the circumstances, police immediately treated the scene as a homicide. They noted that the spot was difficult to reach, being 4,000 feet up the side of a mountain on winding roads. And it's important to note that this wasn't the kind of place that you would just accidentally stumble across. You would have to know the area to end up there. In addition to that, the police also believed that the body hadn't been dragged to the spot because, based on the topography, it would have been too difficult to do so, which meant that more than likely, the murder took place at the exact location where the skeletal remains were found. After making this discovery, the remains were sent to the North Carolina Medical Examiner's Office, and the police spent the following days combing the area looking for additional evidence. If they found anything more, they have not released that information publicly. Now, back at the Medical Examiner's Office, they completed their analysis, and they determined that the remains were those of a white female, likely 40 to 55 years old, who had probably been there for a year or maybe even 2 years. And there were only a few identifying features. The victim had, quote, real bad arthritis in one of her knees and also had extensive dental work. According to the Philadelphia Inquirer, the medical examiner couldn't determine a cause of death. The bones showed no obvious signs of trauma, no bullet holes, no knife marks. However, I will say the victim's bra had punctures and slashes, suggesting that she may have been stabbed. Now, the woman's death was ruled a homicide largely because the body had been buried and wrapped in a blanket. So at this point, we have this unidentified female in the middle of nowhere, North Carolina, in a place that would most likely be accessed by someone who was a local. And as far as the victim's concerned, yeah, we know she was murdered, but we have no clue who she is. But that's about to change when a doctor who's paying attention gets involved and ties this whole thing together. We're going to take our last break. We'll be right back. Okay, so for a while, no one knew who these remains belonged to. And as I mentioned before the break, an emergency room doctor 65 miles away saw the news story about this discovery, and he remembered the information Jeff had sent to the hospital about Judy and decided to contact the Philadelphia Police Department. So at that point, Judy's dental records were sent to North Carolina, and unfortunately, they were a match. It was official. Judy Smith had been found dead over 600 miles away from where she was last seen alive. When the police informed Judy's family of her murder, they let the police know that she had no connections to North Carolina, so no one could explain what she was doing there. And to make matters even stranger, if you picked up on it, the outfit that Judy was wearing when she was found, it was completely different from what she had been wearing when she was last seen in Philadelphia. And we also talked about that red backpack and how she brought it everywhere with her. And yet, as I sit here with you right now, that backpack and her identification have never been found. And according to Unsolved Mysteries, Judy's family did not recognize the clothes she was wearing or the blue backpack or the sunglasses that were found near her body. So this led law enforcement to believe that most likely the blue backpack and the sunglasses belonged to her killer. I don't know if I necessarily agree with that. We already established that she was wearing different clothes. It's possible that during her time between leaving Philadelphia and getting to North Carolina, she switched outfits, maybe picked up the backpack, maybe bought the sunglasses, and those were also her belongings. And as far as these items potentially belonging to the killer, sure, that could be the case, but I would pose the question to law enforcement, why would this person leave behind items that belong to them and could potentially connect them to the murder? Doesn't seem to make a lot of sense. And it does seem like they spent some time trying to bury these items so that they wouldn't be found. I think it's more than likely, if I had to take a guess at it, that these items were also in Judy's possession before she was murdered. So now we have this discovery and the confirmation that this is in fact Judy Smith. So the police set out to figure out how Judy traveled from Philadelphia to North Carolina and what she did while she was there. They combed through all the travel records, they interviewed locals in nearby towns, and they were hoping that someone had seen Judy before her murder. Surprisingly, several people reported seeing a woman matching her description in Asheville. And it gets even stranger because a few shop owners remembered talking to a quote Judy from Boston, and there was even a hotel clerk who recalled her staying at the hotel from April 10th to April 12th. Now, here's the real twist. None of these witnesses, none of them, thought that there was anything wrong with Judy, and she seemed perfectly fine, not disoriented at all. Now, if that's not strange enough, listen to this curveball. One witness, a clerk named Joanne, told Unsolved Mysteries that she remembered seeing Judy in April. Joanne said, quote, "She seemed very alert to me. She told me her husband was an attorney, that they were from Boston, and that he was at a convention in Pennsylvania. She said that she had decided to come down here." What do you think of that, right? Didn't see that one coming, did you? Well, don't feel bad about it, because I didn't either. When I read it, my jaw dropped. I did not expect this late in the story to have this information, because with everything we've been told so far, I'm not expecting to hear from someone who perceived Judy as being coherent and alert. Not only that, think about the specificity in what was told to her. Does that sound like a person who didn't know who they were or where they were? Doesn't to me. Now, you could say maybe Joanne heard it on the news or read it in a flyer, and that's always possible, but you have to ask yourself the question, why would she do that? And I would hope that she was vetted by law enforcement. So with that assumption, I believe what she said. And by believing what she said, it opens a whole new can of worms, because we were going down this path of maybe this was someone who was having some mental struggles and got lost and ended up in an area they weren't familiar with, to a person who may have deliberately fled Philadelphia because she wanted to get away from something or someone. But that's where the trail of evidence went cold, and based on what they had uncovered, the Buncombe County Sheriff's Office speculated that maybe Judy wanted some time away from the marriage, or possibly considered starting a new life in North Carolina. And while she was there, that's when she met her killer. As far as what transpired, you have a few scenarios. It could be a situation where she was walking through the woods by herself and she crossed paths with this person. You also have a scenario where this individual befriended her and convinced her to go on a walk with her in the woods, and that's where they killed her. That's not as important right now. What's really important is that whoever this person is, their identity still remains a mystery. Now, years pass with no evidence being found in Judy's case. Then in January of 2005, Jeff passed away at the age of 59, never knowing what truly happened to Judy. There have been no major updates in the case, and many are left with questions. One of them being, did she intentionally leave Philadelphia, or is there more to the story than we know? And the biggest question of all, who killed Judy Smith? Her friends and family still seek those answers. Okay, let's dive into the perspective, and there's a couple things I want to clear up. First off, I mentioned at the top of the episode that Judy had forgotten her ID at home, so she had to take a later flight. And there were people who thought that was suspicious and that maybe she had done that intentionally. They asked Jeff about that. He doesn't believe that's the case. He mentioned that that rule where you had to use an ID to get on the plane had only been in effect for about 18 months. And during that time, she had only traveled one time. So it was very possible that she just forgot. He didn't see anything suspicious about it at all. I tend to agree with him, because if she was trying to avoid being with him, she took the later flight. She took a flight 6 hours later and was at his hotel by that night. So was she doing? I don't know. I don't see anything suspicious about it. And there's been nothing presented publicly that would dictate otherwise. The second thing I wanted to bring up, when I talked about the body being discovered, the assessment by the people involved was that the body had been there for a year or maybe even 2 years. So that probably perked some of your ears up when you heard that, thinking, well, that's not possible. She had only been missing 5 months at that time. And you're right. But the reality is, experts can get it wrong. And based on the decomposition of the body and the condition it was in, it's an educated guess, but it wouldn't be the first time that one of these experts are completely off when they're with their assessment. I mean, just take the Preble Penny case that we did for Criminal Coffee Company. And I don't even think I've mentioned Criminal Coffee on Detective Perspective. I know you see the cup every week. We worked a case for this where we funded the case that was 60 years old. And in that case, the forensic anthropologist stated that based on their analysis, the skeletal remains belonged to a 50-year-old woman. Well, fast forward to us getting involved and funding the DNA testing, it was actually learned that through the DNA, the skeletal remains belonged to a male, not a female. And that's where these things can happen. It's not intentional, but not every person on the job, police officer, prosecutor, medical examiner, forensic psychologist, they're not all created equal. And sometimes even good detectives, good medical examiners, good lawyers can make mistakes as well. So a lot of explanations for it. I wouldn't put too much stock in the fact that the assessment said 1 to 2 years. As I mentioned, there were dental records. It was confirmed that those dental records belonged to Judy. There's no doubt that was her body. And another thing that I wanted to bring up was this theory being floated around that Judy was potentially the victim of serial killer Gary Michael Hilton. Now, according to law enforcement, they did look into this theory and there's no connection whatsoever. So where do we go from here? Well, we have two things going on. I'm limited by the information that's available publicly, and they were limited by the science and technology available at the time, which could be a good thing for us. But before we talk about that, let's talk about witnesses. It's been 30 years. It's widely known in cold cases that as time progresses, it's less and less likely that someone's going to come forward. Memories fade, people relocate, people also die, and it's less likely that you're going to get that witness that's going to remember something all these years later. Not impossible, but not likely. I think the only way you get something verbally is either a dying declaration from the killer or from someone who directly knew the killer and the killer confessed to them. And for whatever reason, whether it was because of just loyalty or they were maybe a child of the killer, they didn't come forward at the time, but due to changes in circumstances, maybe the killer died, they finally come forward to tell us what they know. It's not going to be the top of my list, but is it possible? Of course it is. I think the more likely scenario is based on what was recovered from the crime scene. You have the blue backpack, you have the sunglasses, and you obviously have Judy's body. You also have cash. The hope is that the suspect at some point touched one of these items. And the fact that they were buried could assist us. That means that the conditions on the outside didn't get to them as much. Yes, they would have been buried for 5 months, which can make things difficult. But if the evidence was preserved correctly, and I'm specifically talking about the backpack, the sunglasses, and the cash, if they preserve that in a way that it can be analyzed now, maybe it can be swabbed and DNA can be retrieved. And if DNA can be retrieved with the advancements in DNA science and technology, they may be able to develop a sequence that can be put into the database and potentially match to someone who's already in our system. That's really the only thing that I could see law enforcement doing at this point if they haven't done it already. And if it's a situation where they've thought about doing that, if the Buncombe County Sheriff's Department is sitting here listening or watching this, if finances are the problem, reach out to me. We will fund it through Criminal Coffee and we'll get whatever you need DNA tested immediately. You have my word. Call me up, email me. We'll take care of it. But that aside, based on what we do have, what do I think happened? And we have a limited amount of information and we don't know the credibility of the witnesses that we do have. But if we're to take everything at face value, I think there is a real possibility, without knowing Jeff or their situation, that for one reason or another, Judy wanted to get away. Maybe she was feeling some type of way. Maybe she didn't have the clearest mindset. Maybe that was due to something that she had just experienced with Jeff. Maybe they had a falling out. And for some reason, and I could kind of understand why, we talked about it, Jeff wasn't maybe completely honest with law enforcement, not because he did anything wrong, but he didn't want them to focus on the wrong person. So maybe there's an argument or something similar to that. Judy's out there. Maybe they had been having problems, and she decides this is an opportunity to get away for a little bit and maybe consider starting a new life in North Carolina, or at least visiting, right? I don't think she was there long, maybe a day or two. And as we said in the episode, somehow, some way, she came across the wrong person and they took advantage of the situation and they killed her. I do think, without knowing a ton about Judy, the plan was not to just drop off the map and stay out there forever without talking to her children or even talking to Jeff. But what happened to her was unexpected and there was nothing she could do about it. So at this point, all we can do is honor her by finding the person responsible, not only for her, but for her friends and family. So I'm not going to do it behind this desk, but maybe someone out there can do something. So just to recap, here's what we have. Judy Smith left her Philadelphia hotel on April 10th, 1997, and never returned. Months later, on September 7th, hunters in Pisgah National Forest near Asheville, North Carolina, discovered Judy's remains partially buried in a shallow grave. Her body was over 600 miles from where she was last seen, dressed in clothing her family did not recognize. So if you or anyone you know has information about the murder of Judy Smith, please contact the Buncombe County Sheriff's Department at 828-250-6670. And I just, another reminder, if anybody from that department is working this case and is listening or watching this episode, and you know what you have in the evidence locker and you think it can be tested for DNA, but financial resources are a problem, reach out to me at cases@detectiveperspectivepod.com or contact@criminalcoffeeco.com. And we will get you that money. That will not be a problem. And as always, my final words go out to the friends and family of Judy Smith. I know Jeff is no longer here. That's the problem with these cold cases, especially when they get to 30 plus years. The people that were directly affected by it, they pass. And you also have a scenario where the killer is either on their deathbed or they've passed away as well. So that's the unfortunate circumstance as this time continues to go on, but we're not going to stop fighting. So if Judy's family is watching this, know that we're here with you and we're going to keep this case alive. And I hope that there's maybe some new energy in this case, even if it's just from the Buncombe County Sheriff's Department, where they say, hey, there's some people who are interested. Maybe there's something we can do. And now we have some financial resources available. So we're going to continue on this fight with you. I hope there's an update in this case. And if there is, as always, I will be right here to update all of you. Until then, that's going to do it for me. Everyone stay safe out there, and I'll see you soon.